It is Thursday, September 6, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callum.
And I'm Christina Thomas. The Slaughter Pin Jam Music Festival will be held Friday, September 7th through the 9th in downtown Bentonville. Educational programs, live performances from nationally known and local bluegrass artists, the Bluegrass Bike Ride, jam sessions, and more will be offered. DowntownBentonville.org or call 254-0254 for more information.
KUAF is supported by the Peel Compton Foundation, supporting the Peel Mansion and Historic Gardens in Bentonville. Mansion tours are hourly from 10 until 3, Tuesday through Saturday. The business office, now located at the Compton Conference Center at 312 North Main. Additional information available at peelcompton.org.
Ahead on Ozarks, medicinal marijuana is on the ballot in Arkansas this fall. What passage of the measure might mean for the state? Plus, Robert Lawrence talks about his first novel, Departure Lounge, that is set partly in Madison County.
But first, Tuesday was Census Day for colleges across the state, and unofficial enrollment numbers are in for Northwest Arkansas Community College. This fall, just over 8,400 students are enrolled there, a decrease of 2 2/3% from last year's unofficial enrollment total of about 8,600 students. Consequently, the number of credit hours being taken this year also down. The unofficial count of student semester credit hours is just under 78,000. That's down nearly 2.9% from the hours taken a year ago. According to a release issued by the college, administrators say that the drop in student semester credit hours has an impact on budgeted revenues for the 2012-2013 fiscal year. More than 50% of the college's revenue is reportedly generated through tuition and fees.
As we reported earlier this week, the University of Arkansas in Fort Smith will receive federal grant money for its Upward Bound math and science programs. Yesterday, U.S. Senators Mark Pryor and John Bozeman, as well as U.S. Representatives Rick Crawford and Steve Womack, announced that three other universities in Arkansas will receive awards for their Upward Bound programs. Of those three, the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville and Arkansas Tech University in Russellville each will receive $250,000.
Work continues at the Sebastian County Juvenile Detention Center. County Judge David Hudson says that the county is renovating a building across from the detention center to add more classroom space for use by the center.
Hopefully we're going to be able to get that project done this year so we can have separate classrooms for family in need of services, males and females, and delinquent males and females, as well as separate classrooms for 18 to 21 years individuals that are held in juvenile detention. They all have to be separated in order to meet state standards, and so that project's ongoing.
Hudson says that while subcontractors are doing the actual work on the facility, the county is acting as the main contractor for the project.
A drop in sales tax collections is being blamed for state revenues coming in below expectations and below last year's figures. The Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration said yesterday that net available revenues in August totaled just over $369 million. State economist John Shelnut says that that's about $4.5 million below last year and $3 million below forecast.
It's a surprise in the sense that sales tax is down 2 months in a row, but you can see year to date it has not impacted the forecast that much. So it's a concern going forward. We'll see what the sales look like next month, which includes the back-to-school sales tax holiday that's occurred in August but reported in September.
Overall for the fiscal year, Shelnut says Arkansas is still above forecast by $12 million.
With rains from the remnants of Hurricane Isaac that moved through the state last week, drought conditions abated for much of Arkansas. According to data released this morning by the National Drought Mitigation Center, only 12.4% of the state remains under exceptional drought conditions, the most extreme drought classification by the center. That figure is down from 45.5% last week. Areas still under exceptional drought are isolated to the northwest and north-central portions of the state. Portions of Arkansas under extreme and severe drought conditions, the next two steps below exceptional drought, decreased by nearly 20%. The center says that most of the short-term drought indicators have improved, but some long-term issues from the drought still linger.
Forecast calls for partly cloudy skies tonight with a possibility of a thunderstorm. Lows in the low to mid-70s. 30% chance for rain in northwest Arkansas, 20% chance for rain in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, partly cloudy with a chance for thunderstorms. Highs in the low to mid-90s. Tomorrow evening, mostly cloudy with a 60% chance for rain with lows in the low 60s. In November, Arkansas voters will decide on a ballot initiative to legalize medical marijuana, widely reported as the first state in the South to do so. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich talks with state and national advocates about how the law might be implemented, if passed, as well as with the manager of a top cannabis dispensary in California, where medical marijuana has been legal for 16 years.
California's Proposition 215, titled the Compassionate Use Act, passed by voter initiative in 1996, was a political watershed for proponents of medical marijuana. Patients could, for the first time in modern history, circumvent the black market and, with a doctor's recommendation, purchase high-grade cannabis products, from nonprofit storefronts to ingest, smoke, drink, or inhale through a vaporizer. As many as 500 dispensaries operate across the state with names like Karma Combo, Grassroots, and The Vapor Room. But some, like Harborside Health Center, based in Oakland, stand by their medical paradigm. In operation for 6 years, the nonprofit collective sells medical marijuana, but also provides substance abuse and mental health counseling, acupuncture treatment, and yoga. General Manager Andrew D'Angelo.
That's all very evident as soon as you walk into our facility, which is large, open, well-lit, lots of sunlight, windows coming in. Our slogan is out of the shadows and into the light, and we take a lot of pride in the design of our facility, which is actually an award-winning design.
Unlike other dispensary websites with larger-than-life photos of cannabis bud oozing with resin, Harborside's website is illustrated with simple iconography of flowers, concentrates, topicals, edibles, and seeds. The staff also hold classes on medicinal marijuana cultivation for authorized patients and caregivers seeking to treat chemotherapy-associated nausea, AIDS anorexia, glaucoma, inflammation associated with arthritis, fibromyalgia, hypertension, osteoporosis, even Alzheimer's.
Medical cannabis dispensaries, when operated in a safe, transparent way in collaboration with the community, which means regulation, we can bring benefits to communities, not harms. And we have brought tremendous benefits to our community here in Oakland, and we have brought no harm.
Although Andrew D'Angelo declined saying how much his dispensary grosses, he did say the state gets a huge cut of the pot pie in revenue, permit fees, and sales taxes, 46 cents on every dollar. The collective also donates a portion of earnings to the needy, he said. But even California's established dispensaries remain at risk due to federal drug agents stepping up enforcement by conducting raids and reportedly seizing leased property on which some operate. Still, marijuana reformists like Andrew D'Angelo persist.
We live in Oakland, which is a very diverse community. So about half of our patronage is non-white in background. We have all sorts of ages of people from 18 years old all the way to patients in their 80s from all socioeconomic backgrounds imaginable. One thing that medical cannabis has taught me is that when you are in pain or when you need medicine to function in your daily life because you're suffering from cancer or you have glaucoma, that doesn't discriminate.
But all Harborside patients must first obtain a recommendation by a doctor.
The doctor must be in good standing with the California Medical Board. We verify both of these things multiple times before you can enter the space, the part of the facility that actually dispenses the medical cannabis.
Doctors and providers can be found online at weedsmap.com. In Washington, Michigan, Alaska, Hawaii, Montana, New Jersey, Rhode Island, New Mexico, and 8 other states where medicinal pot is legal, Morgan Fox is communications manager at the Marijuana Policy Project, founded in 1995 to end federal marijuana prohibition for both medical and non-medical use. It counts 50,000 members.
Simply put, the people are tired of spending their tax money putting sick people in jail for using a medicine that they and their doctor feel is appropriate for them. And particularly when you see the benefits that this medicine has for people with very severe illnesses such as cancer, HIV, AIDS, multiple sclerosis, it becomes an issue of compassion beyond all partisan lines.
The Marijuana Policy Project lent both financial and organizing assistance to Arkansans for Compassionate Care, sponsors of Arkansas's Medical Marijuana Act. Spokesperson Chris Kell says if passed, the state will have a strong hand in how the law is implemented.
Arkansas Department of Health will make the final determinations on where the dispensaries are put up, but the idea is that we'll have one dispensary for every 25 drug stores that are in the state, and we'll try to have it as set out as broadly as we can to cover the largest population possible that fits within the five-mile radius.
And a portion of revenue from sales would be turned back to the Arkansas Department of Health, he said.
The dispensaries themselves would actually produce the marijuana.
So they would grow the marijuana?
Yes, the dispensaries would grow the marijuana. That's correct.
And would that be field crops or would it be inside aquaculture? Do you know?
Yeah, it all has to be produced inside under lock and key or have some other equivalent security provisions. That has to go for the dispensaries as well as individuals.
Arkansas patients and certain caregivers who live more than 5 miles from a dispensary would be allowed to grow medicinal pot as much as 2.5 ounces.
The patient or their caregiver, if they're beyond 5 miles of a dispensary, can grow the marijuana under lock and key within their home with a limit of 6 plants. And the dispensaries, I think, are limited to 95 plants.
The ballot initiative provides that seeds and seedlings can be sold and transported within the state, but if out of state, must be donated by a sanctioned dispensary. And how will Arkansas residents secure a prescription for medicinal marijuana?
Well, first of all, it's not a prescription. It's a recommendation. And if a patient's physician believes that a patient would benefit from medicinal marijuana, the physician can write a recommendation that then goes to the health department. And then the health department decides if the patient qualifies under the provisions of the ballot initiative, and they determine in the end whether or not the patient can use medical marijuana under this law.
This summer, a Kentucky legislator filed a bill to legalize medicinal marijuana in a state which has long fought to allow for agricultural hemp cultivation. In the 19th century, hemp was plantation-grown for twine, rope, and cloth. It only contains a trace of the psychoactive medicinal THC, that's tetrahydrocannabinol, unlike its more potent cousin, cannabis indica, or marijuana. Still, hemp and marijuana were both federally prohibited in the early 20th century. Hemp fiber and seed are increasingly, however, being processed into cloth, food, and cosmetics, openly sold in the United States marketplace, but the plant must be outsourced, primarily from China. 10 states have legalized hemp cultivation, some seeking to grow it for biomass and even biofuels, but all are constrained from that under the drug enforcement law. That's why groups like the Marijuana Policy Project are working to educate Americans on states' rights to cultivate and dispense marijuana and hemp. Again, spokesperson Morgan Fox.
But that's what's so great about our federalist system, that we can experiment on a state-by-state basis with which policies work best for those particular states. Unfortunately, federal interference is making it very, very difficult to do so.
Opponents to medical marijuana say that pharmaceutical-grade THC-based drugs exist, so there is no need to legalize pot.
Yes, that's a substance called dronabinol. It's marketed under the name of Marinol. And what we've actually found is that this substance is not a synthetic form of marijuana and from the whole plant. It is a synthesized version of just one chemical found in marijuana. And THC just also happens to be the primary psychoactive agent. So what patients have found is that in a lot of cases, they don't get all of the benefits that the chemicals that are present in marijuana provide working in consort. We've also had many, many reports that it's just simply too impairing. The actual like psychoactive effects are simply too strong, and it makes it unpleasant for lots of patients. It's far, far stronger than smoked or eaten marijuana.
Peer review studies on the efficacy of medicinal cannabis is limited due to it being classified as a Schedule I federally prohibited substance. Yet, according to the U.S. Patent Office, the U.S. Department of Human Services purchased several medicinal cannabinoid patents in 2003 to treat inflammation, symptoms due to Parkinson's disease, and certain dementia disorders.
There's actually quite a bit of research out there, but unfortunately there's not enough. And science is just starting to unlock the amazing potential of the endocannabinoid system and how marijuana works in consort with that. So I think that the more research we get, the better.
Nearly one-fifth of U.S. states have legalized medicinal marijuana, yet the Federal Bureau of Investigation Uniform Crime Report cites in 2010 of 1,600,000 total arrests for drug abuse violations, 46% were for marijuana possession, an increase of 6% since 2000, despite the Department of Justice issuing a prosecutorial directive to ease recreational user arrest. Morgan Fox with the Marijuana Policy Project.
But the real thing that really needs to be looked at is the fact that state and local law enforcement gets an incredible amount of money from the federal government in the form of grants because of having large marijuana arrest rates. They're also able to get all sorts of things from asset forfeiture. So there's definitely an economic incentive for police departments, both state and local, to try to halt marijuana reform because it represents a huge cash cow for them.
A July Talk Business Hendricks College poll found Arkansans to be evenly divided on the issue of medical marijuana. The survey of 585 likely voters had a margin of error of plus or minus 4%. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Coalition to Preserve Arkansas Values last week filed a lawsuit with the Arkansas Supreme Court, requesting the medical marijuana proposal be struck from the ballot, claiming marijuana is illegal under current federal drug law. The ballot title is confusing and proposal vaguely worded. In response, Chris Kell, spokesperson for Arkansans for Compassionate Care, told Ozarks at Large that their measure was approved by both the state attorney general and secretary of state, and that voters should be allowed to decide for themselves.
This is Ozarks at Large. The sixth annual Ozark Writers Live event at the Fayetteville Public Library is an all-day affair that takes place Saturday. Novelists, essayists, journalists, and other published writers will talk about their work and discuss the art of writing and the business of publishing with those who are interested. One of the writers scheduled to appear is Mara Leverett, author of Devil's Knot. That's a book about the West Memphis Three that is now being adapted into a feature film starring Reese Witherspoon and Colin Firth. Though many writers dream of having a book turned into a Hollywood film, Mara Leverett says it was never on her to-do list.
It's only with hindsight that I can see how improbable that was. I was, and still am, a reporter. Basically, that's what I've always done. And I have essentially followed my nose, which I think is what every writer does, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. You follow your nose, your mind, your heart, and you are led by curiosity and interest in whatever it is that has made you sit down to write. And in my case, starting as a general assignment reporter, I was covering county fairs and school board meetings, the things that new reporters, as a general rule, all do. And I was fortunate enough to have editors who allowed me a lot of rein and allowed me to kind of choose my subjects more and more. And I found myself being drawn to those subjects that concerned the aspects of the criminal justice system. I look back now and see how terribly underreported that branch of government is, in my view. And so I, in a lot of ways, had this field pretty much to myself. And there's just so much that goes on there and so few reporters who cover it. And so I, and especially some really grimy cases that took a lot of investigation and long time of work. As it happened then, out of all of my just reporting on this, I have had three or four cases that have risen to the top, or you might say sunk to the bottom, as being especially bad and especially deserving of more and more focused attention. And I can look back and see that I have spent more than 25 years on some of these cases. So I realize now, kind of extreme journalism in that respect. Who could have ever imagined it? And certainly I never dreamed at the beginning of any of this that any of it would lead towards Hollywood. But it has, and I'm really glad about that, because I think that these are things that deserve a lot of exposure.
When you have a case like the one in West Memphis, and then you have this somewhat, at least to non-legal minds, very obscure Alford plea, and people are scrambling to figure out what it means, and you see press coast to coast worldwide trying to figure it out, and it's something you have been with for some time. What is that like to watch others come in and report on it who might not, well, certainly don't know nearly as much as you, but you watch on cable news networks or you read in magazine articles their writing or their broadcasting about something that you've been involved with for years? What is that like for you?
Well, I'm always impressed by what a good job a lot of reporters do at informing themselves quickly on something as complex as that Alford plea was. It is, frankly, impossible to be very informed about it for me or anyone else at this point, because it is so debatable and so unprecedented. And as the judge said on the day that he set those men free, it will be discussed probably for years to come. I think that's an understatement. So we're talking about something brand new in American legal history. And I frankly was just thrilled the day that they got out. And I was kind of stunned to be in the courtroom. It all happened very quickly, and to see that happening after almost 18 years in prison for them, and to have known those men throughout that entire time and visited them often in prison, and see them standing there in suits now, and then a few minutes later see them outside the courthouse free, was really what happened was I started thinking I was having a hard time breathing, and I finally went to the doctor, and he said, you know, sometimes you can have too much stress, but it's good stress. it affected me physically. I was really happy. I was really excited, and I think that the attention on this case has only begun, actually. There is going to be a release very soon of the film made by Peter Jackson and his wife called West of Memphis. That's going to hit Arkansas pretty hard, I think, with regard to this case. And then next year, Damien Echols' book is to come out this month. I think in a few days it will be released. And then next year, the film of Devil's Knot will come out. So I am really sad that this state that I have cared about and loved so much, is going to take it on the chin so badly because of the behavior of some of our officials in this case. It outrages me. But that's the way that the officials have chosen to proceed, and it's going to harm us, I'm afraid.
And I, an almost lifetime Arkansan, understands that. But then again, that's what journalism is for, right? To shine the light.
Yeah, I think so, and much better that that happened than that we go on and on and on. In fact, one of the things that I am incorporating now into every time I talk about my books or my work is a call for everybody to start demanding that we get cameras in all our courtrooms. The West Memphis 3 would not be out of prison now if HBO had not had cameras in that courtroom, and HBO would not have gotten cameras into that courtroom if one judge had not, for whatever reason, made the decision, which all judges are allowed to do, never do, that I know of, except in this one case. And because he did make that decision, and they were there because it was so, the charge of Satanism and three murders of three little boys were so sensational, then this grew into the movement that it became. Everybody who goes on trial deserves that same opportunity to have their case recorded. We're supposed to, the Sixth Amendment requires that trials be public, but in this age, public does not mean everybody takes off work and goes down to the courthouse and hangs around and watches it like in To Kill a Mockingbird.
I was thinking of Gregory Peck as you were saying that, yeah.
Yeah, but we are not in that time anymore. This is the 21st century when you can put your five-year-old's birthday party on YouTube, and yet something as important as a trial where life and liberty are at stake, almost all courts in this state and in this country, including the U.S. Supreme Court, do not allow those to be electronically recorded. So that has got to change. Public means something different now than it did in the 18th century.
Mara Leverett is the author of Devil's Knot, as well as The Boys on the Tracks, and is one of the featured speakers at the Ozark Writers Live event at the Fayetteville Public Library Saturday.
The Ozark Writers Live event is Saturday from 10 until 4. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, another writer who will be involved in the event. Kyle will talk with Richard Knack about his career writing fantasy novels that have made the New York Times bestsellers list.
It's Thursday, September 6, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm not a country music fan.
Okay.
This comes as no surprise to anyone who knows me. But there's a show tonight at the Alma Performing Arts Center that is country music, and I want you to go.
Okay.
If I can get there, I'm going to go.
All right.
It is the Country Current Band, which is part of the United States Navy Band.
Okay.
You know, the United States Navy Band is broken up into
sure.
all sorts of specialty bands. Country Current is their country and bluegrass band.
I did not know this existed.
Me either.
One of 14 bands in the Navy. And they attract musicians from Nashville who join the Navy to play in this band.
They join the Navy just to play in the band?
Yes.
You have to go through everything that anyone else goes through to train. You don't
yes,
get a free pass. I mean, you're trained and you do all that. But then, yeah. You are in the band.
And the musician that one of our reporters talked to, whose name has left me, I'm so sorry, read the story in last week's What's Up, but he had been in Nashville, decided he was going to join the Navy and work in electronics, and they found out about him. He said, no, you're going to come and be the front man for this band. It will be so much fun. It's free, but tickets are required at 7 o'clock at the Alma Performing Arts Center. Call 632-2129 to get a ticket.
That's what you have to do.
Yes.
Okay.
And Boston performs tonight at 8 o'clock at the Downstream Casino near Joplin. You've got to know this band. More Than a Feeling? That's
right.
Boston.
I do know that song.
Very, very big in the late 70s into the early and mid-80s. Their first three albums all sold very well.
I'm still astonished at the run of bands we've had. 38 Special is playing tomorrow night at the River Festival in Fort Smith. We've had Def Leppard. Now we've got Boston. Tickets start at $40 at downstreamcasino.com.
All right.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Robert Lawrence has lived in Florida, New Mexico, and now resides in Madison County. All of those locations figure in his first novel, The Departure Lounge. Lawrence was the Robert A. Loeffler Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Arkansas and also taught in Florida and in Albuquerque. He's now retired and looks after some former racehorses. Departure Lounge, his novel, is set in the mid-1980s, before cell phones or email, and it centers around a letter writer and his friends. Though the letter writer knows them all, they don't know each other, and the reader is allowed to see how their lives almost, then do, connect. Robert Lawrence will read from his novel tomorrow night at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. This week, he visited the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about his book.
At the end, there's an acknowledgement, a very strange acknowledgement, you may have noticed, to a person whose name I can't remember, who a long time ago read part of what is now Chapter 2 and said, I'd like to have a beer with her, in reference to the character who's now called Britt. And, you know, I was a new writer, new fiction writer, and I took that, I suppose, as the way most new fiction writers would take it, that is, a compliment. And it took me, 10 years or so for it to come to me that it wasn't a compliment at all. I think what she was saying, I entirely lost track of her. She was an MFA student at the university. I think what she meant was get out of her head, go down the mountain, and let me have a beer with her. Stop being so internal and have her do something. And once I did that, once I decided that's what she actually meant, it opened up all that detail, maybe too much detail. One of Elmore Leonard's famous 10 rules is not so much detail. He admires greatly a Hemingway story in which, I forget which one, in which the only thing we are told about the protagonist, he's called the American and the girl he walked in with. Well, I'm no Hemingway. and so I do go on. It gave me the luxury of writing at length about scenes.
But what I liked about the characters, and as they slowly sort of interweave, was the internal, because we know so much about what they're thinking. And that, I think, propels the story. So I'm glad you didn't lose too much of the internal.
Maybe not. As you've already pointed out, I didn't take much out. I just added all the external details of what people were wearing and what they were eating and what the scene looked like and what the scenery looked like. And there's lots of dialogue. And here's another occurrence. I was reading a story written by a friend of mine in which there was a law office interview. And I sent him an email. I said, I like the story, but that's the shortest law office interview that has ever happened. Things don't happen that efficiently. Well, I quickly realized that I was subject to my own criticism, that I had some meetings between students and faculty members in their offices where they got right down to business and talked about what would advance the plot and then said goodbye. And that's not the way teachers talk to students. And so the conversations became quite digressive, I guess, and people talk about all kinds of things and that are off the topic, and it eventually comes back. And we've all had those kinds of topics, those kinds of conversations where somebody will say, wait a minute, how do we get here? And then somebody else will say, well, we were talking about that, and then we got to here, and then you mentioned that. And so, yeah, I've written a bit like that.
It's funny you bring up faculty and meetings, because the book opens with a faculty or an academic committee. And a very contentious and at times a petty meeting. And I'm thinking that a lot of people, academic or not, who have been involved with committees can recognize some of the things that were happening there.
Yeah, it's a faculty meeting of a sharply divided faculty, which is not a pretty thing to watch. Luckily, I haven't been involved in many of them, but once you start saying, well, I think I'm going to have a sharply divided faculty, then you can have fun with that. And that's what I did. And maybe so. Maybe I hope it doesn't hit too close to home for too many people because, like I say, it's not pretty to watch.
I just – and see, this is the danger in your readers because we might assume something. I just assumed, oh, gosh, he has to have been through a meeting like this because it was – it seemed pitch perfect.
You know, with everything in the book, I suppose, the places are real, but the events are embellished. And so that would be true there, too. I've been in some contentious meetings, but nothing like that.
When did you get the idea for the spine of the story with one person who has connections to others and how they kind of affect each other? When did this idea come to you?
I guess the first step was... at one point, as I mentioned, I like to travel and I like to write, and I was a letter writer. As I mentioned to another group of people, maybe I should say to some of your audience that a letter is sort of like an email, except it's on paper. And I liked writing letters, and so I thought, okay, here's my niche. I'll be a travel writer who writes stories in the form of letters. And so I tried out a few of those, and I showed them to a couple of people, one of whom said, write fiction. And I said, oh, well, I'd never thought of that, really, and that's an interesting idea. So, all right, we'll take this letter that I've written and create the recipient. That's fun. And I don't know, at some point it occurred to me that the story should be more about the recipients than it is about the letter writer. And then there was, as you point out, what would it be, 2 degrees of separation, the fact that the recipients all know the letter writer, but they don't know each other. I think everybody's been kind of interested in that idea about what would my friends think of each other if they actually met, because we all have friends that are close to us but who are strangers to each other. So I started to write that way, the lives of three strangers might become intertwined against the background of these letters from their mutual friend who's traveling around.
And it's interesting because you allow us to be these voyeurs and to kind of we get to see the whole narrative.
Yeah, well, they don't.
Right.
That's the fun of it for me, I think, to say that by looking outside at these characters as they go about here are two people who don't know each other, but they have a close mutual friend, and they're in a restaurant together. Are they going to discover that? I kind of like that question, that idea. It adds a little mystery, I guess, just to the way we go through life.
It reminded me somewhat of a Robert Altman movie. You know, some of those Altman movies where we, the viewer, know all the characters, and some of them know each other, but they'll pass by and not know that they almost know each other.
That's high praise, which I'll take. I don't claim it for myself, but thanks.
Yeah.
I'm glad you saw that going on. And one of the last things I had to do, there's the Tallahassee part of the story. There's the Albuquerque part of the story. And for a long time, they were largely separate. And I decided that just can't be. Then it just becomes two novellas sitting between the same cover. And so I created Nikki Wallace, who kind of goes back and forth between the two worlds, and it's quite a coincidence. And I think the way some people will react to the story depends upon whether I'm able to sell that coincidence to people or not.
Robert Lawrence will read from and discuss his first novel, The Departure Lounge, tomorrow night at the place he calls the Jewel of Dixon Street, Nightbird Books. He lives in Madison County and was the Robert A. Loeffler Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Arkansas before his retirement.
Yesterday, the University of Arkansas announced a generous gift that will allow the institution to transform the old field house into a state-of-the-art performance venue. On Wednesday's edition of Ozarks, we brought you comments from Chancellor David Gerhardt. Today, we have more from the old field house, the site of yesterday's news conference. Jim and Joyce Faulkner are those responsible for the $6 million gift. They address the 150 or so in attendance, beginning by saying that they have 5 reasons for donating to the university. Their 5 children, all of whom attended the U of A.
And because of the education they received, they have a better life today because of it. And I could say also that we have 8 grandchildren, and we hope before too long we'll have several of those grandchildren who are Razorbacks also.
Jim Faulkner, himself an alumnus, along with his wife Joyce, are long supporters of education and the arts at the U of A, having given to both the band and journalism departments, among others. Joyce took a moment to address the crowd by explaining why they are now supporting this performing arts center. The Faulkners are both from small towns. At the time, they lacked access to theater, music, symphonies, but they did what they could, taking piano lessons, serving in marching bands. Jim was in the university band Marching 100 and wrote the full score for the Gabalee musical as a senior.
So we go back a long time and and not even knowing that we were getting to this point. So when it was suggested to us that we might help in creating a new performing arts center for the university, it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to combine our appreciation of the arts with our love for the university. We lived here in the 50s, so we loved it then, we love it now.
She says that this opportunity doesn't come along often, to get in on the ground floor of something as special as this is going to be, and that the repurposing of this building will help all students, all of Fayetteville, and all of Arkansas.
And we feel like this goes along with our Faulkner family philosophy to give back. And that's why we're here today.
Thank you, Joyce. I have to tell you now a couple of quick stories about this building. I'm not sure any of you here can remember when these things occurred.
Jim Faulkner goes on to say that 63 years ago, when he was a freshman, the field house was where the Razorbacks played basketball. The boxing matches were also held here. As a fraternity pledge, Jim was made to be the fraternity's welterweight representative. As an amateur, it didn't go well. He wound up in shame and with a big red nose. His second story takes place 60 years ago, as a senior working toward a journalism degree.
And I also had a new job. My job was working in the corner office, not the corner office, but the third office down from this very building. The corner office belonged to the then athletic director, John Barnhill, and he hired me to write sports stories about the Arkansas Razorbacks. And I did that for the entire year, and it was like a scholarship for me, which I badly needed because the money situation at that time was pretty tough, and it enabled me to get through and get my degree in journalism. So I feel like this building and the university taught me 2 important lessons. The first one had to do with what should not be. I should not be a boxer, so I took up tennis instead. And secondly, it allowed me to hone the talents I had in the journalism field, and journalism and communications were the areas that I spent most of my working years involved with. So we're indebted to the university, we're indebted to the people who are here now, and we think that it's our pleasure to make this building have a second life as a beautiful performing arts center, and it's our pleasure to do so. Thank you.
The 650-seat Performing Arts Center will more than double capacity of current performance spaces on campus. When it is completed in about 3 years, it will bear the name of Jim and Joyce Faulkner.
It's Thursday, September 6th. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And we are joined by Jody Beznoska, who is Vice President of Communications at Walton Arts Center, and someone who I'm very jealous of.
Why?
What did you do this Labor Day weekend? What did you do that was out of the ordinary?
Oh, I was at the Naturals game on Saturday, I believe, and I got to throw out the first pitch.
Ah. I was going to say going to a Naturals game. That's not that unusual.
But she got to throw out the first pitch.
I got to throw out the first pitch.
Yeah. That's really exciting.
It was very fun, but it was also a little nerve-wracking because it was a last-minute thing. We didn't really know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so for about 10 minutes, I sat there going, okay, don't embarrass yourself. Don't embarrass yourself. Make sure it's a good throw. Make sure you don't try too mm-hmm. hard. Make, you know, don't.
So you didn't have a chance to practice?
No, there was no practice.
Did you throw from the mound? Did you go to the front of the mound?
Well, I had a strategy about mm-hmm. that. I decided that I wouldn't stand up. I didn't want to do the grass because that felt a little too
right.
wimpy. But I also didn't want to go all the way up on the mound because, one, I would probably trip over myself, and, two, I felt maybe that's trying a little too hard.
Right.
So I went right in the middle.
Okay.
I was right at the lip of the mound, far okay. enough so that I knew I could throw it and not have it be too embarrassing. It was a bit of a lob.
That's okay.
But that was also a strategy
okay.
we discussed.
Okay.
I said, yeah, I think I'll lob it so that way there's no risk of it bouncing
right.
in.
Right.
And it went well.
Great.
It was fun.
That's not why you came to talk.
No, know? But it was a lot of fun. And the reason we were out there was we were doing Shrek at the Ballpark Day, which was really adorable because we had these little cardboard ears, Shrek ears, that we were handing out to all the kids. It was fairly fantastic. If you want some cuteness, go to our Facebook page mm-hmm. and check out the pictures because they're really adorable. Don't look at the pictures mm-hmm. of me. Look at the pictures of the kids with the ears on.
Now, tomorrow night, it's going to get loud in Walton Arts.
Oh, it's going to be awesome. The truck is outside my window. I can see it. It's the Stomp truck.
I saw it yesterday.
And yesterday, I was watching our crew unload trash cans, one right after the other, big, shiny trash cans. And the Stomp tech crew is here now. The performers are not here yet. They will get here tomorrow. And then we will have four shows for the public. We'll have one tomorrow night at 8, two on Saturday, 2 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and Sunday at 2 o'clock. So only four
right.
four chances to see the
no
show.
Sunday night.
No Sunday night. They're leaving. They're getting back on the road. But, you know, yeah, it's going to get loud, and hopefully we'll see some new. You know, everyone who saw Stomp 4 or 5 years ago will get to see some new acts as well. So that's this weekend. And then we don't have anything. Walton Arts Center doesn't really have anything going on for the next week or so after that. But we will have Theater Squared continuing their run of Noises Off. And then SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, will have their first piece, their first concert on the 16th,
that's
I think.
That's correct.
Of September and
Sunday afternoon,
Sunday
as opposed
afternoon.
To most of them are Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. A Sunday afternoon. I think the concert is at 3 p.m.
It is.
With a 2 o'clock creative conversation that hosted by Kyle.
Yes.
And going to be a wonderful, wonderful show. I will be there. I hope you all will be there so I can visit with you. And then we come back up on September 20th with Plena Libra, the Puerto Rican band. Part of the first show in our 10x10 art series. So there will be a creative conversation prior to that. There'll be the post-show party in the lobby that we've become familiar with, a chance for you to write on the sticky notes what you think about the show. And then there will be dancing. We're going to pull out the first couple rows of the seats in the theater and have a little mini dance floor in front of the stage.
It's going to be fun.
Which will be fun. Because I get the impression that a band like this, you might not be sitting in your seat while you're listening. It's probably the kind of music that makes you want to get up and dance.
Have fun.
Yeah, it'd be great. And then the first show in our Starlight Jazz series will be the following night. That's Gretchen Parlato. That's two shows, 7 and 9, I believe.
Tickets are on sale for that.
Tickets are on sale for Gretchen. And you can also buy, and this is just an incredible deal, you can also buy the whole jazz package. And we're calling it the Jazz Lovers Package. And you can save up to 20% on tickets. So there's 5 shows in the series. So if you were to
You're kind of getting one free.
Yeah, if you were to buy the full package, you'd get one free. And if you go to the 9 o'clock show, the tickets are unbelievably affordable. So no excuse for missing jazz if you want to see that. So. But the first show, again, will be the vocalist, Gretchen Parlato, on the 21st. I want to give everyone a heads up that October is not as far away as you would think.
We were just talking about that.
Gosh, I can't believe it. Don Williams will be our first show in October, and those tickets are going really fast. And then we will have a whole string of 10x10 Arts Series shows after that. We have 3 almost within a week of each other, and they're all very, very different. We have the first show in our Caravan Sarai series, which is this wonderful program that we're working on in partnership with the King Fahd Center at the University, highlighting artists and music from Morocco. And then the following night, couldn't be more different, we will have the Tokyo String Quartet. And then the next following week, also couldn't be more different, we will have LA Theater Works doing a version of Pride and Prejudice.
And all of the last three you mentioned are part of the 10x10.
Mm-hmm.
You do not have to buy the series.
Correct.
You can buy them individually.
Yep.
Most tickets, $10 a pop.
Most tickets, $10 a piece. So there's 4 shows on the 10x10 in the next month, and you could come to all of them for $40. It's pretty great. Pretty great. And then we were talking about Shrek. Shrek will end October for us, and it will actually run over Halloween. Mm-hmm. So parents, grandparents out there, if your kids like Shrek, the Shrek costume, it might be fun to have that come out this year. We will have lots of Halloween festivities going on for Shrek, like costume parades and trick-or-treating in the lobby and all of that.
Now, Christina, last week, see if I'm remembering this correctly. Jody kind of teased us, right? With a couple of, she did.
Because
I asked if there are
big news,
right?
Yeah.
Some shows that could be added. And you said you might be able to tell us about one this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, this is pretty exciting. We are going to be putting the Wailers on sale.
That's in Bob Marley.
As in Bob Marley and
his
the
Wailers. Legendary band.
His band will be coming in November. The date for the show is the 10th of November, and the tickets for it will go on sale next week. So not Friday. Sometimes we put tickets on sale Friday, not this Friday, but next week they'll actually go on sale on Wednesday.
Okay.
And the tickets are really affordable. I think they start at something like $16.
Ooh. So it's Wednesday,
be fun. Next week Wednesday tickets will go on sale, and the show's in November, so not too much time before that happens. But that's a wonderful example of how sometimes things just drop in our lap, and you know, we couldn't get that booked in time to put our guidebook and our season out, but we get a chance to add it on. Good reason to listen to this.
That's right.
Because I will tell you early what's coming up.
Great.
So you can get tickets to all of these things at 443-5600 or waltonartscenter.org, or you can come visit us at the box office. The parking on Dixon Street and in the lot across from us is free until 2:00. And we do have an exhibition up in our gallery right now. It's a holdover from the Roots Festival. It's the Woody Guthrie exhibition, and it's really fun. It's interactive. You can participate, and so that will be up for a couple more weeks, and then we will be putting a new exhibition up that we'll have lots more to talk about related to that. But it's a wonderful project that we've commissioned from Kathy Thompson to celebrate our 20 years.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about this.
It's really, really amazing, and so maybe I'll hold that one, and we can talk about that next week.
Okay.
Thank you, Jody. Jody Besnoska is Vice President of Communications with Walton Arts Center.
And this is Ozarks at Large. Let's see. Yesterday, Antoinette and I asked a trivia question for people who are interested in earning tickets to Polo in the Ozarks. It takes place Saturday. It benefits Lifestyles, and it's literally polo. Tomorrow, in fact, on the show, Antoinette's talking to the longtime announcer of the event.
How fun.
Yes. So the question, and we now do it by email. You can send responses to these questions to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. The question was, what three current summer Olympic events have no Americans ever won a medal participating in said event?
Okay.
And we said the first person to get all three would win match and gala tickets. You get the whole thing. And then I put a hint on Facebook yesterday afternoon. Anyone who went to the Ozarks at Large Facebook page get
it's
one.
Generous.
Yeah, well, you know. And so everybody else who could get at least one was entered in the match ticket. So first of all, credit goes to Shannon Roll. Shannon, in minutes, had the answer of all three, which are?
Table tennis.
Right.
Badminton.
Right.
Handball.
Right. And kudos for you calling it handball and not team handball. The rest of the world calls it handball. Anyway, Shannon Roll, we have your tickets for the gala and the match. And then everybody else who's entered in the ceramic cow and Jessica Keehy. Jessica, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. She won the tickets to the match. Those tickets will be here. We'll be in touch with you.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Wakalula.
Wakalula. I like that. Where is Wakalula?
It's north of Ozark.
Yes. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Thanks so much, Christina.
Happy Thursday.